Proceed.
Proceed. Engage. Well, welcome to another Launch It podcast. Today we got me, as always, Matt, KP.
We got myself, KP, and today we have another very special guest, Gary Newbury. He'll be talking, all things retail logistics with us, and shining light in terms of his experiences over the last few years in the logistics space, and educating and showing upon how, especially with how things have proceeded after COVID-19 in terms of the retail sector and their logistics and final mile and that sort of stuff. So,
and the challenges.
And the challenges. So I'm pretty sure it'll be a very interesting one. I know on one of our earlier update podcast tidbits we did, we kind of went through different articles, and one of the things I did mention, there was a spike in retail buying because of, people more buying more stuff to deliver to their houses. So Amazon and that sort of stuff, and I'm pretty sure you can shine some light on terms of maybe struggles that that they've had, or positive things that have come out of this from the retail side of things.
But yeah, we'll let Gary start off by introducing himself and kind of run a little bit with retail logistics.
Yeah, well, I've been in retail logistics in its kind of widest sense. That includes manufacturing, third-party logistics, wholesaling, retail, and specifically the last mile for quite a few years, like 30, and I've worked in somewhere in the order of 30 or 40 different organizations, often tackling mission critical assignments, being brought in as an interim executive to either make a change happen or lead an organization through a change or to recover an organization. So I've worked at all levels, C-suite, CEO, CFO, CSCO, Chief Supply Chain Officer, as well as supporting teams, supporting difficult, I would say difficultly woven teams to actually get a clear idea of vision, to develop strategies, and to then help them to learn how to execute efficiently.
So you know what you're talking about, what you're talking about.
I don't know if that qualifies me.
The resume looks good.
I'll give it a try.
So, and I think KP kind of led with the question, and he alluded about it. There's a bit of a struggle right now in retail logistics, but maybe let's take a step back and talk about what were the struggles maybe 10 years ago in logistics and retail, and what were the biggest things that you were tackling then, and how is it looking at like today?
Yeah, see, 10 years ago, I was in the UK, and just before 10 years ago, so like about 12 years ago, I actually I recovered and set a strategy and got it all working at a company called Home Delivery Network. And it was the largest two-man home delivery. I shouldn't say two-man, should I? I should say two-person, two-man home delivery organization in the UK. And we were delivering somewhere in between 7,500 and 8,500 deliveries into people's homes every day, room of choice.
Wow.
Kind of stuff. 1,000 people. It was unionized when I arrived. I had a failure to agree. Not I didn't cause it. I inherited it along with a whole range of different issues. So I had a real big turnaround situation to work through. And one of the focuses I had was to really elevate the performance. And that was all by changing the way we routed, how we view, the pooling of orders, where we did stuff from, and generally how we did things. And I moved dropped the vehicle from an average of about 25, 26 when I arrived to 40. Now, that doesn't sound too much, but when you go, when you come to Canada and look at last mile operations, two man or whatever, the ugly and heavies, you're lucky to get 15 on a truck. So we were already at 25, so that would be sort of when all the planets align, we get a 25 out of a brick, 25 pieces of furniture, whatever it might be, onto a brick truck. But I was already starting it, so to get that to 40 was a big achievement. And as a result, we went into peak, looking at a peak of an uplift of 50% volume, and I was laying off temporary staff and handing back temporary vehicles. Now, I make that reference just to sort of give a little bit of credibility to what I say. We were dealing with all of Amazon.co.uk's heavies and uglies. We were doing all of Little Woods, the majority of Debenhams, House of Fraser, Tesco's, Marks and Spencer. We sometimes had billiards tables, can you believe that, with four-man lift. So back then, I was in an environment which had a high degree of maturity when it came to retailing. And having said that, the ethos within England, or within the UK, was there was a strong emphasis on cost, but what overrode that was quality. I had to hit performance targets. It wasn't like we want it at lowest cost and we like you to hit these kind of time windows and stuff. It was all about the actual quality of delivery. So as I arrived in Canada and you know, not sort of casting aspersions over what I saw, but the route, for instance, the route and approach at GFS was much more about cost, and the service windows were often seen as nice to haves. So I came from a world where service was first and then cost was second. And I don't think, I certainly the pandemic probably changed that dynamic, but certainly that's what I left the UK with, is always focus on servicing the customer, making sure you do what they need you to do and make sure the cost is sort of under control. So in terms of retailing, we were doing e-commerce. I mean, all the work that came through HDNL was either effectively e-commerce, it was either through a mail catalogue, or it was e-commerce, things like amazon.co.uk. And that had been, it was an existing business. It was not a startup by any stretch of imagination. It had been doing this business and got, in some ways, getting itself into a bit of a pickle way before I'd arrived. So when I come to Canada and I went out networking with a lot of people in a short span of time, I met a lot of present CEOs of typically third party logistics companies. And all I could do is talk about last mile because it's just like in my blood. And they go, oh, that's really interesting. But nobody would pay for it because they obviously got a message that last mile is free. So I ain't doing it. But it's kind of caught on now, including the free.
Yeah, that's a funny contrast too, because we don't often think about the European context. I'm glad you kind of brought that UK portion in, because I've heard this often before, even on the trucking side, it's more service driven than it is cost driven. And it's more trucker oriented, where the trucker goes, I can do these loads. These are the parameters. I can do it to meet your service deadlines. And this is the cost. There's no degree of negotiation to the same level as we have here, where we sacrifice service on the basis of that cost, right?
Would you say, Gary, that's just the based on like a cultural thing, like a country culture thing in terms of like the UK versus Canada? Or like, why would you say that different occurs from your experience?
I'm going to give you a little example of the paradigm we're trapped in. So going back to 2017, towards the end of, I think it was, Galen Weston, who is one of the big family members of the Weston Group, which owns Shoppers Drug Mart, Loblaws, and all that kind of stuff. He was reported as saying, because I read it in real time, he said that we're putting click and collect thing into 104 stores, but we've just done it and there doesn't seem to be any great uptake. I'm not sure if words to the effect of, I'm not really sure if it's going to take off. It's because, guess what? It hasn't taken off because you haven't offered it. You haven't educated the customer about this service and the benefits of it. And of course, guess what? Bang, we're into a pandemic and everyone's screaming for either click and collect or home delivery. Yep. So I think some of it is it may be a cultural thing, but I would kind of perhaps wrap it up in a different way and just say there's a paradigm thing that in the UK, the retailers and the consumers have been on a trip together, and the UK were into e-commerce back in the 90s. So you had probably Amazon in Jeff Bezos' garage doing things and sending out books with FedEx, whoever it was. You had Grocery Gateway here, which was quite revolutionary, but very manual. And you had Tesco's. I think it was in 1996, you could actually place an order on their website to get groceries at home.
Really?
Yeah. So we've been at it for a long time. And I remember going to a conference in 2000, we just about to break through the Y2K, and everyone was talking about mobile commerce and all this kind of stuff. And it was in the context of, I think Watterson's might have been there, and they're thinking, oh, I think we need to do kind of bricks and clicks, don't we, around here? People were like really, and I was involved in a number of dot-coms, which didn't go too well after I left. But I left it. We could argue I left in just in time, but I did a good job, and unfortunately handed over to people who were pretty who wanted a nice job of it. And when you're in a startup, especially in that period of time, where you just had to really roll your sleeve up and forget about, you know, the role you had, you know, what it might be like on the outside. And I was writing process charts, I was doing Java programming with the guys and talking to my team, or it was their team I was working for, but given a real good roasting on a Mayfair building upstairs, saying, you need to be doing this, guys, otherwise it ain't going to take off. So, you know, during that period of time, there was huge excitement about the prospect of internet and what that's going to bring in terms of convenience to consumers, and trying to educate them. And of course, along came the smartphone, and it really did allow the consumers to get way ahead of the retailers, and the retailers have been charging along trying to catch up with them and try to introduce kind of new ideas, new ways of doing things, the mobile apps, etc. Here in Canada, we are, I think we're considerably behind, although I think in the last year we've had to accelerate. There's been no choice. Mm-hmm. And the good thing about Canadians, when they're under pressure, they do actually think, to an extent, think clearly, but they certainly move from firefighting to execution. And I make the difference there. Firefighting is just literally running around every day. You come in at 9, you do your firefight, you go home at 5, but tomorrow's exactly the same. You're still dealing with all the stupid issues that you should have dealt with months, years ago. But when you get into execution, you've got a clear idea in your mind as to what you want to do. And all this stuff around the edges becomes almost irrelevant. And you just focus into the thing you want to do. So for instance, Mastermind Toys, toy retailer for my grandchildren, I should say, children. You go in there, it's a nice shop, you get all your presents wrapped and stuff like that. Guess what? They went into, you know, just when all the kids were at home in the lockdown and you wanted to, you know, entertain Johnny, but you had your work to do, and Johnny was going, daddy, oh, I need to get a toy, do it online. Mastermind Toys? No. Guess what? They got one now. They realized they had to focus into this, and they got themselves web enabled to be able to take orders, fulfill them from the stores. Many of those stores are actually freestanding, so they had the advantage of being able to effectively keep operating through the pandemic when their store was closed. But this is the power of Canadians when they're under proper pressure. Much of the pressure they feel at the, you know, in general terms, in steady state, is, I think, is self-induced. They're not particularly brilliant at diagnosing problems correctly. It's easy to diagnose, oh, I think that's wrong, but it's a symptom. It's getting into that really deep analysis, understanding it, and then acting on that. And they often need a little bit of a push to make that connection, and then to move from firefight to execution.
And I think you and I talked about some of our calls, and we were talking about how China and India are so further ahead on their retail experience that you can order something and it'll be at your door, like you said, like, I think it was an hour or something.
Yeah, it's in China, yeah.
Yeah, and it's crazy because Americans think of themselves as the forefront of this technology. But even just after this conversation, within a few minutes, where I'm going, well, Britain had the Amazon idea already back in the day. Nice. You really think about it, Sears catalogs have been around forever too. That's the original concept of what Amazon is, and look where Sears is now. They had the idea, they had the network, they had everything.
Well, Sears is a really interesting case. That is excellent network for getting stuff in a country that's full of huge amount of rural and remote areas. and you could order something from that catalog, and I guess within a few days, you could pick it up, you know, and I can't even say some of these wretched names of towns in this country, that the ones that I can't pronounce, like really far out, you could get stuff. You could pick it up from a local, you know, pickup place. And they had this great infrastructure, and they could have been, they could have knocked Amazon for six, but somewhere along the retail trail, instead of thinking, guess what? We're a logistics company who also sells stuff. They actually just carried on saying we sell stuff. Was that logistics? Well, it's a cost center. And then they bought it, well, they had a takeover and a merger with the Kmart and all that lot. And it all became a financial thing, which really doesn't play very well to understanding supply chain capabilities and logistics capabilities. As soon as you get a finance person in, especially one with limited imagination or interest, everything gets reduced to cost per case, and we're done. From either a retailing point of view, there's no flair, or from a logistics point of view, there's no development of a capability which may help you to set trends.
So I think, KP, you and I were talking about this before, about Canadian Tire.
Yeah.
You work on Canadian Tire. You do a lot with Canadian Tire in your current day-to-day. What would be a good question that you think that you can ask, we can ask Gary, in terms of how they're positioning themselves in this pandemic?
Yeah, I think a good question on that sense would be, like, we know Canadian Tire is a you know, massive retailer here in Canada. And I guess before kind of handling their account, you know, I thought most of their stuff, they would, I guess, source domestically, because you think that Canadian Tire is a Canadian company. But there's a lot of stuff that they're actually importing in from, let's just say, the States, from a lot of their vendors or stuff that's coming from overseas, right? So it's just interesting to see how, you know, they're able to kind of put all the pieces together to give that experience to the consumer to go pick up the item from the shelf, right? But not kind of being on the back end of things and seeing how it's all mastermind, you can kind of see how things can be maybe more efficient, or not maybe more efficient, but there has to be a way where for the consumer, the product is at the shelf, so they really see the back end what goes on it, for like 3PLs, the manufacturers, and that sort of stuff, to make it more streamlined, right? I guess from your experience, and I guess maybe from major corporations you've worked with, how can corporations better suit themselves to meet demands of, you know, manufacturer supply chains and that sort of thing?
That's a kind of, Canadian Tire is a particularly, I wouldn't say interesting concept, because you have a dealer network. I fell into a trap of thinking they're franchises, so that, you know, the center would tell them exactly how to lay out the store and everything. But, you know, you have the stock and off you go, but it's actually dealer network. So you can go into different Canadian Tires and have actually quite a different experience. And I would argue that Canadian Tire have kind of lost control of the brand, but that's just a personal impression. And what I found difficult in the, just before we went into lockdown, before Canadian Tire went into its lockdown, I placed an order. In fact, my wife placed the order, and we didn't she didn't read the piece of paper, whatever it was, but we were on the piece of paper. It should be ready, you know, it was on Saturday, I think, and it said, should be ready by Sunday lunchtime. So we went up about 1 o'clock, phoned up, had this loud music for about 10 minutes, and then somebody answered it. And they asked for the email reference or whatever it was that we didn't have. So, but it says, be ready here. So we didn't have the email reference. They were in complete chaos. It took them 4 days to pick something literally that was within 10, 15 feet of, you know, the customer service desk. They had to do it this way. So that sort of caused a rather jaundiced view of their, their performance in the online world. Bearing in mind, this wasn't new. I do read the Canadian Tire brochure, the flyer, every week, and for about the previous 2 or 3 years, they'd said, try us for home delivery in the back, on the back page. So so Canadian Tire has had its issues going into lockdown. This is before lockdown. And then during lockdown, it was somewhat chaotic, because people couldn't even place an order on the website. So, you know, it would say, you know, you're trying to select your thing, put it into the cart, and then come and press the button. No, sorry, we can't take your order today, so come back later. how is that possible? You know, I made a few comments on LinkedIn and normally got a resounding, yes, I agree. And with one or two people from, say, Party City or a franchise dealer coming in and say, oh, no, I've had a perfect experience. Well, it's interesting. I've got 150 comments on this thread.
Yeah.
And you're the only one.
So how can they turn it around? Like what sets them apart, their retail experience from someone who's a good retail experience that you can say that they have right now? You know, even, you know, Apple, yeah, as much as I didn't like it when I bought my wife an Apple Watch, but it was somewhat of a organized system. Like, you got the notification, there was a specific website to give you the whole heads up. How can they cater their experience to what you would think would be the appropriate response when you're facing someone like Amazon who doesn't even have any brick and mortar?
Yeah, they've been very, in my mind, they've been very slow to the gate. They've got this Canadian Tire footprint, something in the order of 500 stores. And I think that the publicity is something like, we are within 3 kilometers of 95% of the population. So, you know, it's extreme figures and it's really close. And I've got 4 or 5 I can drive to relatively easy within 10 or 15 minutes. So they've got an absolutely enormous advantage over anybody who's not who wants to be an e-tailer, just like Amazon. What they haven't been able to do up until the pandemic has been to sell a proposition into the dealers to say, when the order comes in, if it's for a customer in your geographical area or they insist to pick it up from your store, we'll divert that order to you. And I think there's been internal wranglings between, you know, the head office wanting to get into the digital age in a big way using the branch network, and the individual dealers saying, I don't see any purpose of this. I like a customer to come in, they shop away, they fill up their basket and they go. If they just come in and just say, I want 3 items, and I go and pick those, so I have to expend energy to do that, and I put them in the bag, and you know, you may or may not give me a system to do that easily, and I give it to the customer, they may not actually come into the store, they may not buy another 3 or 4 things. So I think there's been a kind of uncomfortable thing going on between the dealer network and head office. I think the pandemic's probably demonstrated, especially when they're closed, if they don't integrate the online into the store operation, then guess what? They don't have any sales. So they're standing in a building which is, they don't own, the dealers, they don't own, Canadian Tire own that, and they charge in rental. They've got probably $1 million, maybe $2 million worth of stock just sitting there going nowhere. Some of it might have some date or perishability aspects to it. And they're having to say now, guess what? We have to subscribe to this online, or these other dealers who are a bit more proactive about this, they'll be getting our business. And what happened coming out of the first lockdown, that some people felt it was working for them, and other ones said, no, I still don't want to do it. I'd rather close and have no inventory movement, no sales, and I don't want to be involved. So it's made the proposition of me going into a Canadian Tire store or using a Canadian Tire store for online services, like, there's another level of complexity they've added into the experience. It's different for each store. So in terms of your original question, which I didn't quite catch the whole extent of it, I think you were saying that what could they do in a different way from a supply chain point of view?
Yes.
Which would perhaps position them better.
Correct.
I think that they're probably not too bad operating their supply chain. They've, you know, invested or have created various levels of innovation within how they bring in stuff, typically from the Far East, normally China. Mm-hmm. They bring it in, they bring it in containers, and they actually transload it into 53 footers and move it across if I don't put it on the train, and then tip it into DCs. And I think they've got at least one in Toronto, and I don't know if they've got one on the West Coast somewhere, you know, over in Calgary or Edmonton. I don't know. But the interesting thing for me is that we have country price. For me, it's country pricing, which doesn't seem to fit easily. And I notice it's within Canada, you have country pricing. So I can go into a store in New Finland, store in Vancouver, where it comes in, and the price is the same. It's almost as if, and so they're able to run a national flyer. I suppose that's one of the attractions. And so they have one system that they can run their promotion from the head office and give the subsidies back to the franchisees. But I think there's a flaw in country pricing in the sense of it doesn't recognize the actual nature of the supply chain and the costs that are involved with moving something which comes in from China, comes into Vancouver, may have to be moved to somewhere, whether or not it's Toronto or somewhere in that vicinity, before it gets de-stuffed, racked, picked, and then transported to a dealer network. I don't know too much about the detail of the of Canadian Tire. I've only been inside an older warehouse once or twice. I've been to FGL Sports, and that was a highly manual operation. The one in Bills, is it Bills Avenue? I felt that there were lots of, I would say, improvement opportunities. It's automated, it's broadly automated. Things go on around on quite elderly ASRS systems, and all very slowly. And that's probably why they upgraded to a new warehouse, which was more automated, and it allowed them to run some of the e-commerce, I think, through that, as well as a normal case distribution operation. But I don't know enough about the detail of Canadian Tire to say these are the things they ought to be thinking about. They've got some pretty talented individuals inside the organization are doing, you know, they're doing the normal, they think they're acting lean, that lean things down and reducing costs. But when you actually look at the operations, if they're like every other retailer that I've seen do this, they optimize each element of the logistics of getting it from China to the store, in the sense of they're trying to fill containers, they're trying to get it on the ship at the cheapest rate. They bring it in, they're trying to find the cheapest way of transloading it. They're trying to find vehicles which are as cheap as possible, and the drivers as cheap as possible. But when you look at the overall thing, you often find that when you want to do something quite strategic about the supply chain, it's really hard because everything's being nailed down as individual within the individual logistics silos or activities. And it's very hard to kind of unravel it and say, we want to do something else. Because somebody would say, well, my costs are going to go up. Well, yeah, because when I look at that cost, this cost, and that cost, and add it all up, it's suboptimal. I can actually beat the whole thing just by looking at it in a different way.
So maybe what's your favorite retailer out there, and why do you find their experience the best, and who is it?
I was going to ask the same thing.
Were you? Oh, I'm sorry. I was like, Gary has to have a favorite retailer. There has to be someone.
Well, from a retail supply chain point of view, I'd say something like Zara, because of the way that it's thought about. How, you know, they run a pretty agile supply chain in the truest sense, in the sense of what they do. And I've implemented these kind of systems in manufacturing. What they do is they buy raw material. So they have people going around in the store and bumping into Mrs. Jones. How are you doing, Mrs. Jones? What color, you know, we've got black here. Oh, no, I like orange. Oh, orange is a new black, right? And they send a chitty. I don't know how they collect the detail of it. It all goes back to the central office, in Spain or somewhere. And they have a whole bunch of designers kind of collecting all this information about, you know, where our consumers sort of heading towards. And they take this raw material and they've got a few buckets of different colors and they dip it through and they cut the fabric. And within 2 weeks, it's on the shop floor. if you compare and contrast that to the average retail, the average apparel retailer, like Reitmans or, you know, I was just about to say Aritzia, but I don't think they do that exact thing. But so, say Reitmans, they're ordering now, where are we? They'd probably be ordering now for fall winter, and they're having to place an order for three or four months worth of stock. It's a bet. And they have to, you know, because they're getting it done as cheap as possible in a relatively inflexible situation in China or in Vietnam or Bangladesh, wherever they source most of their apparel from. And they place that order and it starts being made, starts filling up containers, starts coming across the ocean, comes into the warehouse, gets stored. And then as soon as the months change, out it goes into stores, full price for a number of weeks, or it's not shifting. And I hope that we've got the right kind of style, cut and colours. That's 20% off, right? Mark it down 20%, right? Let's go. And it's like, yeah, no, that's not doing it. 30% this week, right? And people know this is going to happen. So, and then finally, you know, maybe towards, you know, in sort of fall winter season, maybe in January, February time, they're like 70% off, 90% off. It sounds like it's some kind of designed promotional scheme. No, it's desperation, because they weren't able to be so close to the point that they wanted to sell it. The lead time was, you know, 6 or 7 months, that they had to assume what the price would be, assuming a number of things, assume the sort of style, cut and color would be about where they were envisaging, and they were exposed. They've always been exposed. You can look at toy manufacturers, they go through the same thing. Say if you're Mattel and you're selling into, I was just about to say Target or Toys R Us here, and you place your order, if you're Toys R Us, you place your order on Mattel. They make it, they bring it into the warehouse, you store it, the warehouse gets very formal, suddenly goes out to the stores, and you've got the runner, you've found the Millennial Falcon, and it's whizzing off the shelves. And you turn around to Mattel, I don't know if they actually make them, you say, we need a few more. I said, sorry, we've tooled up for your next season, we haven't got time or capacity to do that. Mm-hmm. So all these situations but being based on chasing a low labor unit cost have inherent risks. And the pandemic really threw a lot of it up in the air, because when we had lockdown, we were in March, so we were just coming off of this and coming off of winter, fall, and going into spring, summer season. Some of that was on the water, but some of the wiser people said, this isn't gonna be 2 weeks. This could be a number of months. And if that comes in, and we've had no sales to pay for this, and we might not have enough customers to take all this away, and if we do bring it in, we're going to have to deep discount this. We've got to phone up and cancel it, and hopefully we can come out without too much risk. Oh, but it's on the boat. It's on its way to us. That's even worse. So we're committed. We've, you know, probably bought it FOB or whatever. And it's ours. We now have, we've already paid for it, or we're compelled to pay for it. And so we're now compelled to mark it down, because by the time it comes into our system and people can come in to browse, which we found out was June, July time, you know, people are, you know, it's most of the way through summer, and they're looking at, you know, if they take a view that winter's going to carry, you know, we're going to get into winter, they're not looking at summer clothes in June, July, July, August. So my favourite retailer.
Did I stump Gary?
Because I haven't really, I actually quite like Canadian Tire, because it's, we have to think about what do we like. Well, what do I like when I go shopping? I actually like quiet space. I like to look, I'm a sort of tally project kind of guy at weekends. And so I like to go into Canadian Tire, and I always head to the tools and hardware, and just, it's like my 15 minutes of being on my own, looking at all the prices, looking at all the tools. Oh, I've got that one. Oh, yeah, that's on promotion, but I'm not going to pay for that. Oh, I might need that one. Oh, and it's on clearance. Great, I'll buy that. So it's a little kind of treasure hunt for 15 minutes of the weekend. So that's my normal routine. But when we think more seriously about retailers and what they're achieving, and I haven't been in a Target US store, I would have to say Target is my favorite retailer on the basis of what it's doing and how well it's doing, and how well it's executing on its online proposition, how it's integrating into the store. They were one of the ones that went into the store picking model, probably across North America, in a major way, whereas people are still trying to field e-commerce orders from the main warehouse, or having some kind of scratch around the situation. They pick it in the main warehouse and ship it to the store, and then people would imagine it had been picked in the store and pick it up as a click and collect order. So I think that my vote would go to Target because of how it committed a lot of money. It was on a program of about $7 billion to actually establish itself as a mainstay, a leading online player. And it took the great move of buying Shipt, and it came with other, maybe some competitors involved in the ship operation, which is like a kind of an Instacart thing. But it kept that critical volume and it loaded into it itself. It had that opportunity now to offer that 2-hour service, but to control that experience because it owned ship, as opposed to many retailers here in Canada are going to the Instacart because it's so easy to do. We just plug it into your system and they do the rest. They send in a personal shopper, they shop it. There's some kind of tilling up arrangement somewhere along the way. They do it and they do it in 2 hours. And it's fantastic. And one thinks that we've arrived. Well, wait until you have to scale that operation and you want to own the delivery experience. Then you start to find out that you can't do 2 hours, but you've now trained the customer to expect a 2-hour service.
Yep.
I think that this is a retail thing. Like this, yep. That's all they can see. They can't see beyond
the next step. Patients. Yeah.
With you mentioning Target, a couple of years ago, they tried getting into the Canadian market and
they've been here for a while. They were here for a year and a half.
A year and a half, a long while. Would you say the logistics side of the business have to do anything with them, not lasting in Canada, like whether, they set up their distribution centers too far off or, just the, experience of,
Before you go, Gary, I got to say, I was an on-site at the Target warehouse in Milton. It was nothing to do with logistics. I did a fantastic job there the whole time.
Oh, you worked at Target?
No, I worked for Bison at the time. Okay. And I was the on-site for the store deliveries of the Bison segment. Yeah. So I was in the DC. The logistics was top-notch. A shout out to the whole logistics crew. Absolutely think they were fantastic.
Gary, let's pretend he's not here.
I was talking to somebody a couple of weeks ago, and he said that he went out for a ride with one of his drivers delivering yogurt into a local store, which was open, or just about to be opened. And the delivery got refused. And one of the people, and he was there, you can't take this yogurt. We've got no fridges. Two days they were due to open. The whole thing in Canada was chaotic, and there were sort of so many different layers in there. They obviously paid over the top for all the wrong location. They took over Zellers. I thought we'd just tart it up, spend $10 million on each store and make it. The reason why Zellers was where it was and the sort of market, the locations were all in the wrong places. It mm-hmm. served a different market from the aspiration that Target had to serve maybe the kind of Costco market. They had a couple of guys, one I think was a property guy and one was some kind of store operator, trying to set up all the logistics. And, there's a recipe or a factoid that we shouldn't have these kind of people trying to meddle in, large scale logistics. And then their confidence overran themselves and they said, we can do a brand new ERP. We never tried in Target, but we'll make it work here. And then they said, WMS, yeah, put that on top of it. We never tried any of these, and certainly didn't understand if they interface. And we're going to automate, WCS in there, an automated warehouse. Yeah, in Milton, it's great. Yeah. And tell you what, I know we've got a bit of a budget problem. I tell you what, we'll get the interns to put all the item master data and we'll be fine. Yeah, but let's not tell them which system we're in. And today we're on inches and pounds because it's coming from the US. But today, also, we might have some KGs and CMs.
And explain what a KG to CM is to someone, and you know, they have people doing it.
Things are coming into a wet, you know, they're tipping stuff off the trucks and they're going, it can fit into the bay, but the system saying it won't fit into the bay because the item dimensions, the tie highs, and all the other metrics were a right jumble. And they spent, I suppose, the rest of their time in Canada trying to unravel the mess of just a handful of summer interns keying stuff in, having a few drinks, keying a bit more in. And it was one of the big disasters of Canadian retailing. And, you know, I had to say, with all the arrogance that they approached the market, like, we're going to show you guys how to retail. And they could have done if they just did some basic right. You know, it was good riddance to them in Canada, but they had a change of management and kicked those guys out. And Brian Cornell was brought in, and I think they gave him a brief that, that disaster, we've got to do something to recover from that and do it well in our domestic market. And I believe that him and his team have done a really good job.
Yeah, they're interesting. Well, in the US, they went more into that boutique specific locations, more density, smaller stores. Even like that, when they started selling toilet paper, they because normally when you go like even to a Walmart and you buy toilet papers in these large quantities, they said the customer nowadays is more single person living in a condo. Yeah. You don't need a giant packet, so they started selling like 3 packs instead, and that really took off their boutique model, and it really just kind of took off that piece for the U.S. And the Canadians still love going across the border and buying those Target specific things. Yeah. I even have some Target dogs at home because you seem to be able to collect them. Yeah. I like the retail experience. My wife loves it to this day. She's like, when are we going across the border? I'm like, we're in lockdown. She's like, let's risk it. I'm like, no.
Yeah, the trouble with Target, because everybody, Canadians who went across the border, went to Target and the prices were lower, different look and feel and all that lot. And they said, can't wait for you to come to Canada, please. What most Canadians didn't spot was Walmart was just around the corner, but you don't go to Walmart in the US because we've got Walmart here. Mm-hmm. So there was no kind of, if they'd probably spent a bit more time in Walmart, I mean, it looks quite nice, isn't it? Nice price, isn't it? Oh. And they may have then said, our Walmart isn't up to the scratch. Let's knock on the door of Walmart and get them to kind of get the Walmart US experience to Canada. We deserve it. Instead of saying, oh, please come up to Canada, Target.
Yeah.
That was a very expensive lesson for them.
I think they got better after that, but yeah. In the US context, were you going to say something?
No, not really.
I was going to say, Gary, on the retail experience in the last mile, you touched upon a little bit about the GFS piece. That's probably a whole different animal. Deliveries to restaurants. Like how does the logistics being handled in that? How is that project handled differently from the regular retail that we were just describing a few minutes ago?
Yeah, I mean, it will be entirely different because, there were large clients like Red Lobster would take 400 cube. So that was several pallets. And those pallets, just step back from that. I mean, GFS are, you know, at the 3 temperature kind of, situation, composite warehousing, to a freezer, cooler, and dry, and then would be picked obviously as those 3 components, and then merged on the dock, and then put onto the vehicle in the right zones. So when you had something like Red Lobster, which was a kind of prize thing, because they only had 1 delivery a week, no recoveries, no nothing. You got it or you didn't. 400 cube coming off of a vehicle which had, you know, 31 footers, were typically about 750 cube. The drivers love that job because they'll just turn up two and a half hours later, clear off, and then go and do his other piffling little jobs behind them. But when you, the average cube, and this is across the three temperature zones, the average cube when I joined, and I didn't really track it beyond that, was about 54 cubes. So a pallet's worth was going into the average restaurant. But I had actually been pulled in for GFS to look at the smaller deliveries. And when I first arrived, I was given an onboarding with loads of different people and say 20 people, and I had 30 opinions about what I was here to do. So the first thing I did once I absorbed this helpful advice was to actually look at some data and disprove all the theories that most people had, that we were doing a significant amount of small deliveries. It wasn't like we had a few things at 10 cube. A lot of things were at 10 cube and 20 cube and 30 cube. In fact, I defined the small delivery as being about 35 cube, which was half a pallet for all temperatures, which was a few boxes of freezer, a few boxes of cooler, and the rest of it would be dry. So they were experiencing small deliveries because their business was, or that their customer's business was, trying to expand in the footprint, and they were requiring more frequent deliveries of smaller deliveries. And their business model, GFS, was, here's some pallets. They're coming at you once a week. Oh, is it twice a week? That's no good. Three times a week and recoveries. So sometimes they're going to the same place three or four times a week when the contractual agreement may have been just once or twice a week. So I saw that the work that GFS were doing was not dissimilar in part to some of the stuff I did at HDNL, in the sense it was across the threshold and the driver would unload it down the ramp and actually put it into the freezer, into the cooler, into the dry, sometimes rotate the stock. So the driver was doing quite a few value-added things. They would sometimes, if there was some damage on the product, they would try and come to an agreement with a customer about taking it, but having 50% off, those kind of arrangements. So the fact that the driver had an AZ license in Ontario was almost irrelevant. That was the smallest part of their job, was just driving around. The rest of it was very much customer facing. But the routing was interesting. I'd say this is where I get the impression of firefights. So they would have the routine of, you know, for most of like the local area to Milton would be a 5 o'clock cutoff. And guess where we would start routing? Well, not me, the routing team would start routing, knowing that there were add-ons and adjustments, and this would all go through to 6 o'clock, and there was all sales calls, you need to do this. So it was just like chaotic as far as I was concerned, because you either have a cutoff or you don't. And my boss client, call it what you like, he came from a Cisco background, and they were much more corporately minded, which was, we have a cutoff, there we are, because it allows us to be efficient in the next parts of the process. Whereas GFS were much more, I would say, sort of family orientated in terms of their approach. And so if there was a customer we needed to look after and they wanted to, you know, finish their order off at, 5:20, 5:30, that was fine. We would work with that. So they learnt in the routing department not to even start routing until later, but to allow all this straight the kind of, I found that incredible to understand, because every time you allowed that to happen, it meant that somebody who'd actually got their stuff in early to allow you to efficiently pick and all those kind of load and get it to them on time was now delayed. And the whole thing kind of mushroomed when you had a 3 o'clock cutoff, a 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, and then there was one at 7 as well. They all got kind of blurred and moved across. So in the warehouse, they should have come in earlier. Everybody hit the deadline, everyone gets done, trucks get loaded, okay, no problem, and they go out. They actually hit most of the deadlines. But what was happening is that the whole thing was sliding, so the picking got later, and this is a, like the snowballing effect. The picking got later, especially ones that were 5 o'clock deadlines, 6 o'clock deadlines for local deliveries coming out of Milton as opposed to being transited. They would be being picked at 3, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. Those trucks needed to be out the yard by 5 or 6. So they would slip. But also the thing that slowed down the picking was the replen drivers, who were absolutely essential to be kept on the replen, were taken off the replen to pick. And so the orders towards the end of the shift were going out kind of not as full as they should have been, which then caused problems with recoveries. And you can see, like the firefight, this was this, you know, 9 o'clock, right, go and do the firefight, 5 o'clock, done, job. Do the same, you know, rinse and repeat for tomorrow. There didn't seem to be, and I'm sure I'd see this in other organisations, there didn't seem to be a resolve to tackle the real issue, which was, if you have a deadline, make it work. You have a cut-off, make it work.
I think that's a great point. I think that when you talk about those firefights, that 9 o'clock, I just think about our own organization here. It's, I think that's where your mind was going at too.
I guess you're framing that another way, Gary. I was really talking to a couple of my colleagues that we're in such a reactive state right now, and not being in a proactive state. So kind of alluding to what you're saying, that in terms of a lot of individuals don't ever like get into the state of mind of executing. They're always stuck in the other way around of just being bogged down with whatever they're doing and the 9 to 5, and this is it, leaving stuff on my plate and that's it. And don't get into the execution state. So my way of phrasing that was, we're not in a proactive state. So yeah.
They weren't thinking enough ahead to kind of plan and execute with the plan, and there's no deadline to execute the plan. It's like, whatever I can get done, I'll get done. Everything else is mañana kind of thing, right? Like we'll figure it out tomorrow. And my next piece I want to kind of segue for you, because we want to talk a little bit about final mile, is that it seems like the companies like GFS, we talked about Cisco, would be like a natural fit to do final mile for like groceries, but you don't see them kind of get into that position.
It depends on way how you define, I'm going to call it the last mile, because that's where I came from. That whole era of last mile fulfillment, I purposely used fulfillment to suggest online services as opposed to just the transport element. And I know that during the pandemic, Cisco opened up their depots for online traffic so that people of the public could order somehow. I didn't do it myself, but they could order on Cisco and then turn up and somebody run out with a couple of cases of, you know, food.
I didn't know that.
GFS were doing that already, but not particularly to the public. So it's interesting when it was a big Cisco who were doing this, and even though I'd kind of left by then, I was watching some of the commentary on LinkedIn. It's like, and this is new from the GFS people. But imagining, I mean, I used to walk from my office in the main block around to the transport office. And I have to tell you, it was a bit hectic in that transport yard. You had to have a wits about you, and you wouldn't really want the public to come into an area anywhere near the transport yard to collect a couple of boxes of stuff. But what happened at the start of the pandemic, the restaurants all got closed really quickly. The business dried up very quickly. And so what Cisco, I suspect, and I know GFS did, was to actually work with Sobeys, Loblaws, Walmart, because they suddenly had a huge amount of loads to cover and they had nobody to cover. We had some brilliant drivers, some interesting rigs, temperature controlled. They stood up and said, look, we're help. You know, what do you need?
Interesting.
So it wasn't a complete disaster for the GFS business, except, guess what? They had all 8 warehouses jam-packed full of stock, which had normally been turning at a fast rate of knots through, and all of a sudden stopped turning. And so the only thing they could do is use the equipment they had and the experienced drivers they had to go and help the grocers.
Yeah, I guess another question that I didn't have is, I actually saw a video a couple of days ago. I guess Amazon opened up a grocery storefront. I think I was out in California or Seattle, and pretty much what it was, I know I had seen that thing a couple of years ago where you could scan your phone and, you know, then you go up and pay for your thing. But in this one, it was they had an automated shopping cart.
You just drop your stuff in.
You just drop your stuff in, and it automatically scans for you and everything, right?
There's no clerks, nothing. You just grab your stuff and walk out.
And then there's people trying to, like, see if you can scan the cart. You can just, like, throwing their items in, like, a basketball to see if you scanned it, and it still scans it and everything.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I guess the question would be, how does... I know that you kind of framed in a sense that people are somewhat getting away from that model and ordering stuff online, but this kind of puts a different spin on, you know, going inside and, you know, buying your groceries and whatnot. And I can see it, especially from a millennial's point of perspective, that, you know, people wanting to go in and do their actual groceries, right? So I guess two-pronged question is, like, how does a small guy compete with something like that? And I guess only one-pronged question.
Well, the other part I was going to say is, I think it'd be an interesting kind of notion to, like, we were talking about Zara earlier, or even other clothing. So, like, one of my biggest pet peeves when I go retail shopping, that's why I hate it, is people are constantly coming up to you and asking you, like, what do you need help with? What do you need help with? But if I had this system, I'd go definitely go to a store that's like an online version of live.
Yeah.
I just walk in, I grab stuff, put it in my basket, tells me how much it is, tells me if there's other pieces of this in stock. You want to try a different size? Okay, I'll click yes. I'll go in the back, Matt's little pieces sitting there, and I grab it. I'd love that kind of experience. I really don't. I am a people person, but I don't, when I'm shopping, I just want to be left alone. Like you said, you know, 15 minutes of brain space, right?
There's kind of lots of, and I think we're talking about the in-store experience of how to make it more frictionless. Because going into store is full of friction, because you have to go down aisles and find the stock, and, you know, they haven't solved that one. But Amazon brought out a technology which was badged under Amazon Go, where you could literally walk in with, scan your phone on the way in so it recognizes you, and you go and fill up your basket, or fill in your pockets or whatever you do. And all the technology around, which is taking lots of photographs, very expensive technology, knows who you are and is attaching this to your account. And as you literally, there's no till, nothing. You just walk out and then you, ding, ding, your credit card's charge, and maybe a receipt is sent to your inbox. So that's one extreme, and of course, where we have with most retailers is, you know, the tilling. You know, you do your shopping and you do your till. We have issues with all retailers have issues with stock control. I don't know. To enable e-commerce from an in-store picking model, you need to have control of your inventory. It's not possible in the traditional retailer because so many things are moving around. And if you've got a very low volume store and it's small, as soon as you large scale it like a Walmart, it's really hard to keep a control of your inventory. Then you go to the self-checkout or variations of that. Then you get the cart, where you scan yourself, and there's issues around that. And you go to, I think, Sobeys in Oakville. I did say back in November last year, I must go over there. Of course, I just didn't get there and in the pandemic. But they've got a version of the cart. As you put things in, it kind of scans it, so it knows what's in there. And of course, I asked the question that, you know, it's okay when you're in the middle of summer and you roll it out and you put it in your car, but what about in the middle of winter? Or in the trolley, once it's, you know, unloaded all the stuff into me, you just froze it all out, you know, froze it over, it damages all the gummies. Yeah. Is it still reliable?
Mm-hmm.
But the issue with these other schemes, apart from, say, the Amazon, well, there's another version which we tend not to talk about very much in retail. Nothing solves the shelf stock except one thing, RFID.
No, that's what I was about to
say. Tag the product, and anyone goes, it's so expensive. Why should we tag a tin of beans? There's no value in doing that. The tag is as much as a tin. Yeah. Because, do you know what? If you control your inventory, you can do so much. So much is driven from inventory. The whole decisions about what to place orders, what to merchandise, look at the sales performance of certain things, knowing what's on the shelf and what's not on the shelf, knowing where it's been displaced, where someone picks something up and goes, oh, I've seen a better thing. I'll put that there, grab that instead. They don't go running back to the aisle, neatly stack it. They're not a stacking person, they're a consumer.
Mm-hmm.
Be lucky if they put the Tim Hortons mug back in its place. Yeah. So they don't solve the fundamental problem that all retailers have, which is control of shelf stock. And there is only one way of doing that, and it's RFID. The down step from that is the Amazon Go, and everything else is a massive step down, because it doesn't do that. It does this in the trolley, but it doesn't actually check what's still there.
Well, one interesting one I saw today was posted on LinkedIn, was the concept of an urban 53-foot grocery store in a truck. So this 53-foot truck could come by into your area.
Yeah.
It's full of groceries,
yeah,
and you walk into the back of it, and it's meant for areas that are 15 to 20 minutes away from your nearest like grocery store, and you can do all your grocery shopping in there. And I thought that's even a different kind of model to what you're talking about, where it's like you're controlling your inventory, because it's, and like you were saying, it's a very small location and place. I thought that was a pretty interesting model to take on that retailing aspect of it, like, you know, bring the store in a smaller sense to the customer, right?
Sometimes say what was once old is now new, and some of us of a certain age back in England used to get the Corona. I mean, of all things, used to have a Corona, like the soft drink label, yeah, it's called the Corona truck, I guess. And it used to have all fruit and veg and stuff and sweets and whatever. It used to come around to my grand's house on Tuesday evening or something. And everyone used to pour out and buy stuff from us. Well, it was done by the 70s, certainly in the 60s. And the milkman, the milkman used to go out. I know you guys probably had a version of that, but we used to have, guess what? Electric. It's all electric buying.
Yep.
We didn't have gas, petrol. The man used to get his battery charged up, get all his milk bottles on the back, drive around to your neighborhood, get it there for about 6-7 o'clock in the morning, ideally before you went to work, grab it, put it in the fridge, job done. Put out your empties, they recycled the empties. But there's so many things that we used to do, then we over-commercialized the model. We went to plastic, or I think you had bags back here, bags of milk, but I went to...
We still do.
I never got my mind right around that when I first met my wife and said, oh, here's a bag of milk. I said, what? A bag.
How do I drink from this gizmo?
Well, it's just you prodded it, you get it all over you. But the progress was judged by how cheap we could do things, and so we went to plastic containers, which were they were recyclable, but nobody collected them. You had to put them out initially in your rubbish bin until they decided that you could stream your waste, in which case they could be recycled. But all these things that used to be in place suddenly become new again. And
it's funny you talk about that, the recycling of the idea. Like, you and I were talking about this a few weeks ago. I remember my first house when I lived in St. Catharines, we used to have this, it was built in the 50s, they used to have these little windows in the house. And the windows was for the milk or whatever, that the milkman would come by, and it would be locked from one end. He would open it from his end and put the stuff. I'm like, that concept would be so much better now for all your Amazon deliveries. Exactly. You have like a little secure box.
Yeah.
It gets put in, gets closed off. You get a notification. I'm like, that's this recycled idea would be fantastic. Or for the longest time in Canada, the trend was the post should move away from delivering straight to your house.
Yeah.
And you started getting these rural boxes. But now all of a sudden it's like, no, I want everything to my house. And it's going back to deliver to my house, right?
Yeah.
It's funny how these concepts that were standard, we said they're no good. Now they're like, well, maybe they're not so bad, right?
Well, interesting enough, you might take the view that Amazon's retraining Canada Post, because Amazon comes to my doorstep pretty much every other day. Depending on how much shopping I'm doing, how impulsive I am in terms of the buying stuff. But yeah, I get mail to my house, but people just down the street have to go to a box. And I think that I just think that that's sort of like, if you're already going to the house, you can put other stuff with it. If you're going, if your mail version of Canada Post goes to the box, but then you're dealing with parcels, you're still having to go to people's houses. So
why not just do both?
Yeah, it's
it's funny because the mail piece, like we have the box in my house, and I swear I go to my wife, like, when did you get the mail last? Like, oh, 2 or 3 weeks ago. You go in there, it's like stuff jam, and they're like, they're cramming stuff in there because you don't go anymore. You're like, mail, whatever.
My community got bought, the community box got robbed a couple of weeks ago. So my brother went to go check the mail, and like he wasn't working. And then eventually he called Canada Post, and they're like, oh yeah, that community box is robbed. So we gotta change the keys, and you'll get a new key in the mail.
So you know what? You just couldn't get mail for a while. Yeah, but that's just funny. But those like proof of the concepts, like those concepts are, I think it's interesting that they're coming back. And I'm curious to see what, like, we're not aware of here in North America. We talked about it a little bit earlier in the conversation, but like the Chinese and how they're doing retail. Maybe we'll finish off on that piece, Gary. Like, maybe talk about what's so different, why the Chinese can do it so much better than what we're doing in North America, and why we think we're doing it so much better than they are.
Well, I can't answer the other one except hubris.
Well, that's answered it.
Lack of traveling around the world kind of thing, being outward looking as opposed to inward looking. But I think China kind of was late to retail. It's a bit like, I'm trying to think of an analogy, it's probably wrong analogy altogether, but it might demonstrate the point. When the Americans bombed Japan and completely flattened it with Hiroshima, they had to go back to zero.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, they had to rethink the whole manufacturing. And look at them now, they're world class. And in fact, they were world class probably towards the end of the 70s, early 80s. Whereas British industry was plagued with unions and ways of doing things, very traditional collective bargaining agreements. It couldn't get out of it. It required us to close whole tranches of our British Leyland and Austin Morrison. All those things had to be kind of closed down and crammed out and let Japanese manufacturers come over and set up their own plants in the way they want to do it. Toyota, Nissan have very effective plants. And similarly, I think in China, I think they were generally, I don't know too much about the history of their retail. I suspect there's loads and loads of small, really micro retailers. And then the smartphone happened, and then technology happened, and then Alibaba happened. We were a completely different mindset about what retailing was. And all of a sudden it all happened. And now we all look to China to say, what are they doing? Well, unless perhaps you're south of the border, in which case you say we're brilliant. And we start to see, and this was, I think, the example we talked about when we spoke about it, which was they went to in the early stages of their lockdown, they went to live streaming. So you couldn't go out to nightclubs, so they brought the nightclub in. So you could sit down in your chair, turn on the TV screen, dial into the nightclub you wanted to go to, but you couldn't. And they probably had, clickable links that you click on that, and like some Dom Perignon and stuff like that. And within 15 minutes, it would turn up on your doorstep.
That's a cool thing. I would never do like a Twitch nightclub, but that's an interesting concept, right?
Yeah.
Like, I've never even thought about it. I've never even heard of that. And I think, and then you order the food or whatever you want. Like, you're like in a bar. Like, I'm in a lineup, you know?
Yeah.
There's a different twist on what Gary is saying. I know a lot of clubs in New York, what they started doing was like a lot of their celebrity DJs, they started setting up like Zoom calls type of thing.
So oh, really?
You have to pay to get in a club, is you have to pay to get onto the Zoom call. And you're able to see everyone who's there at the same time as well, right? So I guess that's how you pick up girls. Yeah, you see a few girls on one of the things, messenger.
Oh, wow. But there's limitations to how many people you can see on there. It would be kind of
It'd be condensed, but I think on a Zoom call, you can get up to 100 people.
Really?
Yeah.
That's not... I'm trying to figure out which girl to look at. I'm like, hey, which one? That one top left. Hey, are you in the left corner there? No, next one.
You can open it up. See, you can be full screen, But they made a lot of money. I think, they said they almost made as much money as they would on a normal night.
Really?
Yeah, they're charging like $200 to get into their room per person, right? So 200 times 100.
I don't know. Anyway, so sorry, going back to your the streaming the TV, the Dom Perignon comes with alcohol food.
Yeah, and just coming back to the 53-footer, there is a, I can't remember what it's called, Woggle, I don't know. But there's a thing in China that you can actually, you know, you can put your order in, and next thing you know, a vehicle, an autonomous vehicle, has arrived just outside.
The thing KFC!
You know, tells you it's there, you literally, it recognises your face from something you put on your, onto your phone. You go in the shop, it's got control of inventory, it's got all that scanning, photographing thing. You grab a few things, walk off, go back into your house, job done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we posted that a few weeks ago. KP did one about the KFC autonomous vehicle in China. You order the food and it's a little autonomous. It was exactly that. It's funny that mentioned that. That's where we got a little excited. In that
Were you talking about ghost kitchens there?
No, KFC, Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Yeah. Was that a ghost kitchen?
A ghost kitchen, what's that?
Well, that's like you can place an order on a ghost kitchen and ghost kitchen literally is some kind of mobile kitchen. It's not attached to a physical building. It makes it on, you know, makes up your food as it goes, and you can order off it. You can either have it delivered or it can drive to you to deliver.
But was it a ghost kitchen?
I don't know. I think because that video was posted by the company who manufactures the actual vehicles.
Yeah, didn't specify.
And I guess they partnered with KFC. So I don't know in that instance if it was kind of just a promotional thing with the KFC vehicles driving around, or they're promoting it as in like somebody actually ordered and they are picking it up.
Well, because I know to your point, Gator, there's that pizza that the Italians came up with that can be made in like 30 seconds or something. And I think there was a concept about the car where you order a pizza and it like comes up to you and it makes that fresh pizza versus making the pizza. And when you get home, it's like, it's not hot enough. Like, I'm eating cold pizza already, right? So I think that's what we mean by ghost kitchen, right?
No, it's actually, I think it's a mobile kitchen. That's my view of it. It's a theory, but I think it's a mobile, but they will have menus from various restaurants and they take your order and they literally make it there. And then I don't know if the mobility that actually drives it to the thing, or that, you know, they've got a scooter guy who comes and picks it up and takes it to the thing. So it's a cooking facility that allows you to make lots of different things from lots of different restaurant brands, but without having to, you know, you can't sit there, you can't have a meal from it or in it, but it's, you know, takeaway food effectively.
Actually, a YouTuber, his name is Mr. Beast, and he set up his own burger franchise called Beast Burger, and it's premised on ghost kitchen. So essentially, there's a company in the States that took empty cooking facilities that weren't operational. Let's say the restaurant shut down, so they kind of converted those places into places that will cook burgers, and they've partnered with actually say like Uber Eats, Skip the Dishes, and that sort of stuff. So he's launched his restaurant on Uber Eats, Skip the Dishes and stuff, even though he doesn't have an actual storefront. So people will order off his store on Skip the Dishes, but it's actually made at remote locations across USA.
Also, they're utilizing, it's almost like an Airbnb restaurant kind of piece where you can utilize any restaurant in the city if that's underutilized to make his burgers. Yeah. So how do they get the meat? That.
So like the actual facilities, like that's what their business model is, right? So they're already making stuff and they've catered towards like just say, hey, Mr. Beast is partnering with us, so we're gonna buy these sort of products to cater for this when it's ordered from our facility.
Oh, that's pretty neat. Yeah. That's pretty neat.
Yeah, I think we're gonna see lots of kind of small changes and small combinations over the next say couple of years where people go, well, I'm fed up with doing it this way. Let's try this way. And all of a sudden, you know, customers, consumers say, oh, I like that. Or I like that idea, like that concept. And all of a sudden, there's a new business being born out of something which looked quite dead.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to our earlier conversation. We talked about like the retail, and the best way to describe the retail was in the past was very cookie cutter. Like you try to hit as much mass as you could. But as my generation and younger, where the millennial wants more individualistic, very specific thing. Like even when they buy shoes, I'm not sure. I don't understand the obsession with shoes, but there's people out there that they go hunting for shoes. They want custom shoes. They do like they customize it to a level of degree, and then that's the whole mentality. Even as clothes and everything you want. So how does you know you talked about Zara, but like how do you get that super customization, individualistic piece, but still have that brand behind it? I think is where that piece is going to end up. And then how do you mass manufacture? You can't, but you don't want to pay the $500 for a shirt.
Yeah.
And you can't have the manufacturer in your home, right?
Well, you can have it, you know, there's a cost to extreme personalization, but you can have levels of personalization. All you do is say, for instance, if you offer these choices, you just bring in the effectively raw shoe. It's all made up with like, you know, Nike or whoever the brand is. And you go, oh, you like that? Okay. And there's something local, some kind of little sewing machine or whatever it might look like. And it allows it to customize it within this range of options.
Mm.
You've deferred the point of customization until literally you've potentially got a customer standing in front of you with a checkbook out and a credit card in their hands, waiting to pay you. And that's the best possible time. And that's a version of agile. In supply chain terms, that's called postponement.
Right.
But you allow the customer to have some choice over how that product's going to be presented to them. So they
go,
oh, I designed that. And this is a very much a kind of millennial generation need that a lot of like, I want to put my stamp on the world. I want to put a stamp on the things I wear, the things I do.
Yeah, and you kind of saw that the beginnings of that was like the Hong Kong tailor, like that became very, you know what the Hong Kong tailor was? So instead of going getting like to buy a suit, they'd set up these places like at a hotel, they'd send a notification. This was a big hit like maybe 8 years or 6 years ago. And it'd be like a notification, this Hong Kong tailor's there. You'd go in, he'd measure you up perfectly. Yeah. And he'd be like, okay, 2-3 weeks to get this suit, the way designed for you, the way you want it. You can have your own label, everything the way you want it will be delivered to you in 2-3 weeks. Just come back to the hotel and pick it up, right? And that was a kind of neat concept, but that never really went anywhere further after that.
If you go to Hong Kong, you can get all that done overnight.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Gary, you know, I know we had a great conversation. Love the topic about the retail logistics. I don't think we even touched anywhere close what we could have touched upon. There's so many different avenues to go upon.
To be continued.
There's going to be a part two sometime down the road. You know, anybody who's listening, everybody who's listening, reach out to Gary. You know, he has a lot of wealth of knowledge on the topic. He has his own podcast as well. It's a great listen. Very similar format. His panel of guests are just as esteemed as Gary himself. So we have to bring it up to his level by inviting Gary himself to ours.
He's our inspiration. We're working towards his level.
Exactly. reach out to him. He has a lot of great ideas, a lot of different things that he can help you out with. I know I shot him an email and this is how we started talking. And one thing led to another. He's, you know, very nice person to talk to. Very open about it. By all means, everybody who's listening, I highly recommend shooting him a line, following him on LinkedIn. Great, great content there. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, Gary.
Yeah, thanks, Gary. But you can be my publicity officer. Cheers.